Oak Session number 13249, Reel 4.
Charles Anscombe, Reel 4. So, did you have any complaints about the treatment you received from the crew of the Circe?
No, none at all. None at all. I mean, even when we were in hospital, some of them came out to see us.
Now, you were telling me earlier, off the record, about how the Eunice sank the Lucania in error.
Yes.
Can you repeat to me what you know about that?
Well, the Lucania was taking stores. I can't quite remember where it was to, because there was some Italians that were being repatriated from somewhere or other, and they were living under very hard conditions. And I think the general idea was that we were allowing them, unescorted, to take stores to wherever this place was. And we'd agreed that they could come through our areas. We didn't tell them where they were, naturally. But they would have safe conduct, and our people would be told not to attack them. The Una, who was in the next patrol to us, the captain was ill, and he was running a very high temperature. And he didn't get the signal, or so he says, that the Lucania wasn't to be attacked, but it was, and it was sunk. And the Italian Navy took a very dim view of this, and they sent out the Circe, who was one of their crack anti-submarine vessels, to find the culprit.
And they found you?
And they found us.
Did the crew of the Circe talk about the sinking of the Lucania to you?
I can't remember, not to my knowledge, no. I don't think they would have known anything about it. I mean, it was an entirely different operation, really. The two more or less happened together.
So you were taken to POW camp in Italy, first of all?
Yes.
Where to?
To Tirana, just near, not far away from Toronto. And very primitive, the conditions. As I say, the toilets were just holes in the ground with planks across them.
How were you treated by the guards?
Well, the same as I suppose you'd find in any. Some were all right, and some used to, you know, were a bit petty. But even so, I felt that they weren't terribly interested in winning the war. They wanted to get home.
Can you repeat the story that you told me earlier off the record about how you complained about their interference with your Red Cross parcels?
Oh, yes. I went and saw asked to see the major in charge of the camp, and I told him that they were helping themselves. He's told me he'd have me shot, being insulting the Italians like that. But I stuck to my guns, and it didn't happen again anyway. And the padre, her father, I think his name was Rossi, said that he thought there was a misunderstanding and put it over like that, and knowing the language.
Was this in the camp near Taranto?
Yes.
Why were they stealing from the Red Cross parcels?
Because they didn't have anything to eat themselves. I mean, I'd have helped myself. I'm sorry, it wasn't Taranto, it was the next camp I went to.
Where was that?
That was Gravina. That was a new camp.
Whereabouts in Italy is Gravina?
It's not too far from Bari. It's up the east coast. Just where it is, I wouldn't like to say.
Now, can we jump ahead to when Italy capitulated and you got out of camp and returned to the Allied lines?
Yes.
Can you tell me the story of that, please?
Well, in the meantime, Italy had capitulated. And we had been sent to another camp then at Macerata, which was about 8 or 9 miles from Ancona on the east coast. We sort of heard rumours, because some of the guards would talk. I think they wanted to war over so they could get home. And we sort of got a general gist that Italy had capitulated and they'd signed an armistice. So I decided then that I'd stood by my chaps. Can I retract a bit?
Yeah.
Let me get this right. A lot of the chaps, when we were in Tutorano, were repatriated to replace those people that had been picked up in the in Iraq, and they swapped them over, and most of my lads went back on this repatriation. You might have heard of it or not, I don't know, but most of them was. But they didn't let the key people, as they called it, go. Like the chief of RIA, myself, we had to stop. Anyway, they went, and I got as far as Bari, and I was sent back. And let me see what happened then.
You were telling me about when the Italian collapse occurred.
And this was, and then while we were at Macerata, outside Ancona, there, the Italians capitulated and signed an armistice. I got a few lads together and I said, well, the guards had all scarpered, all gone home. Don't blame them either. And we were just living there and I said, well, what do you think? We'll try and make our way south. They said, we agreed, there's about half a dozen of us. So we walked out of the camp. There was nobody to stop us. We could just walk out. And some wanted to stay put. They didn't. They said they'd wait until the war was over. Our object was to get down on the coast, on the eastern coast, the Adriatic coast, and try and pinch a fishing boat or something and sail down the coast, because we knew that we had destroyers doing patrols up the Adriatic, and hopefully we thought we'd pick up with them. But it was not to be. I went ahead with another chap to reconnoitre and see what the coast was like and whether we could get down on the coast. But we got picked up by the guards and taken back to the camp. It was only it wasn't a real serious attempt at escaping. We were just taking advantage of the situation as it was. Well, next time I was being sent to Germany from Macerata, and I decided I didn't want to go.
This was after the Germans had taken over the camp?
Yes, the Germans were sending us to Germany. And I went down and I got myself taught off for a working party, and I went down to Macerata, to the where the trains were going from, and seeing a situation down there, and I thought there's a pretty good chance that you can get away. Because we were loading the chaps, 50 in a boxcar, locking it. And they had guards, armed guards with machine guns on the roofs of these trucks. And I thought it's not beyond the realms of possibility we can get out of this some way. So, anyway, I came back after the working party was over. And I had a bit of hacksaw blade, about that long.
A few inches. A few inches.
Yeah, about 6 to 8 inches. And I had strapped on the sole of my foot with a bit of surgical plaster. Bit pathetic, isn't it? And anyway, we're pushed into this one of these trucks. And I was sitting next to a lance corporal called Dixon. I've never seen him since. I don't know where he lived or where he came from. And I said, I'm going to make a break if I get a possible chance. Well, he said, I'll come with you. I said, well, we don't want a big party. Well, you know, because big parties, you just can't travel through. And we'll try and get out of this train when it slows down. So we decided we'd dig a hole in a digger in the floor of this boxcar. And it had 4x2 crossed like that. So that's 4 inches thick, the floor of this car. And we managed to dig a hole to start this little bit of sawing. And taking it in turns, we went round until we'd sawn a space big enough for us to drop through. We just left a little bit holding it, so it remained in position. But when we were ready for it, we could kick it with our feet. And the train was going up an incline just outside Rimini. And I thought, this is a good chance to go. But prior to that, as soon as the hole had been dug, they all wanted to start, go. But, I mean, that's just fatal. I mean, if they all try to go at once, it would have been, you know, been fatal as far as we were concerned. So I decided that Dixon and I had been the instigators of digging this hole. We were going to have the first choice. And the train slowed down, kicked this piece of wood, and it fell on the line, and it was raining. That was the finest thing in our favour. The guards on the top weren't too alert. Dropped on the line and let the train roll over the top. And if you want an experience like that, I don't advise it. You can see this with the train was jerking. You could see these couplings, you know, swinging. I thought one's going to take my head off any minute. Anyway, she stopped. So we just slide down under the coach and just rolled down the embankment. About 2 seconds afterwards, Dixon came down too. So then we started our walk to the south. Poor old Dixon had bad feet and he couldn't go on. He said he was going to give himself up. I said, well, I'm not. I'm going down and put as much distance as I can between these people and us. And some of the Italians were quite helpful, really. But they couldn't do much because there was German troops all over the place. I mean, they were virtually occupied by the Germans. And got to a place called just north of San Genezio, a place called Santa Maria. And they were just getting up the harvesting the grapes. It was in the autumn, as you remember. And we, in the meantime, I'd picked up with a paratrooper called Frank Hines, who had just recently been captured, and he got away. And we got together, and we got to this place, Santa Maria. And they worked this padrone system in Italy. Did you know that? There is a boss man, a padrone, who, and he rents his land out and the house on it to these peasants. And everything they crop, They have to give him half. Mind you, it's a big fiddle, they don't. So, anyway, so I was with this old chap and his daughter and his wife, very old. Well, they weren't very old, but they seemed old to me. And I worked on there, and I never opened my mouth for nearly 3 weeks.
Well, where was this?
We were in Santa Maria.
Where is this Santa Maria?
Well, it's the biggest town to it is San Genezio. It's about mid-Italy. And then it got a bit too hot for us there, and we went and lived with another chap for a while. And his wife had a son who was a prisoner of the English, and she used to feel sorry for us. And I said to her one day in broken Italian, "Why do you do this for us?" She said, "Well, my son is a prisoner of war, and I only hope the English are treating him well. Do you think they are?" I said, "Oh, yeah, of course they are." Well, we were actually, weren't we? We were feeding them and looking after them well in this country. And anyway, I said to Frank one day, "Look, I'm not hanging around any longer. We were with this bloke, I suppose, maybe a month. I'm going to make a move down." Which we did. And they were very good to us. They killed one of their very few chickens and gave it to us so we could have something to eat on the way. And we made our way south and put up at different places, mostly in barns where there was somewhere to sleep, and we'd try and, you know, scrounge a bit of food, which sometimes we got and sometimes they turned the dogs on us. But mostly they were all right. And sorry, my memory's not so good as it was. And eventually we got to a place on the Grand Sasso. That's the Great Stone of Italy. It's the highest peak in the Apennines. And there's a village near there, Cescara. And they decided that they would take us in, because we were getting nearer the front then. And they sort of looked after us, but then after a while it got too dangerous for them, because the Germans, if they found that anybody was helping anybody, any escaped prisoners, they were just burning their villages down. They weren't all their hayricks and things like that. So they decided on the 1st of December 43, and I'll never forget that date, they would feed us as best they could, but we had to go and live in a cave up the mountains. And they took us to this cave and gave us some blankets and things. While we were in Cescara, there were two majors who were on the run like us, and they pulled up at this same village. And I went and saw them, and they were a major marshal from a sea force and a major sign from the gunners. And I had a chat with them. I said, "You know, they don't want us here, really." And they said, "We rather gathered that." And so they're going to take us to this cave up in the mountain. I suppose you'll be coming too. Well, they said, "Yes, we suppose so." Well, anyway, that was the agreement. We go and live in this cave, which we did, right up until the end of December, on the 31st of December, 43. And during that night, there was a terrific snowstorm, and 6 foot of snow fell at the entrance to our cave. Why I know it was about 6 foot, because I say I'm 5 foot 8, and I could just push my hand up and I could feel it in the air. And we dug most of it. It was mostly drifted round there anyway. We made a space. And I was all for stopping in the cave. And then if anything does happen, they'll be able to find us. We'll probably be taken prisoner again, but that was better than being killed. And the other three went against me, so it was 3-1. And we made a hurdle of some wood and vine and stuff like that, which we had been using against the front of the cave to try and make it, you know, as dry as possible. Anyway, we ripped this back down and laid it on the snow and then crawled over it one at a time and then pull it and turn it over and drop it. So making about 6 foot progress. It was a painfully slow. But the snow was so deep, we couldn't walk on it. And we got some distance down the mountain. And suddenly we heard a rumble. We started an avalanche. And because boulders and trees were coming down. And I saw them coming. I thought, well, they can't possibly miss. They must hit one of us sooner or later. And when it had passed us and it had subsided a bit, I got out of the snow and so did Frank Hines. But we couldn't see a sign of the two majors. We were wandering around, groveling around a bit, and then suddenly we heard a voice. And one of them put his hand up and we saw him. And it was Marshall. We pulled him out of the snow, and his leg was hanging off from here. And
from his thigh?
Eh?
From his thigh?
Yes. Well, it was broken here. It was compound fracture. The bone was sticking out. And I had been, because all coxswains are qualified in first aid, but not much good without any. It's all right when you've got lots of medicines and bandages and things like that, disinfect them, but we had nothing. And anyway, we pulled him out, and I thought, didn't have any wood or anything like to put a splint on. And we bandaged that the best we could with the bits of pieces of rag we had. And I put his feet like that and I tied them together and used this other leg as a splint. I got him reasonably comfortable, I think I did anyway, because he never complained. Then we had a grass round for Syme. And when we got him, I knew it was no good. Because he was bleeding from his nose, his ears and his eyes. Out of my limited knowledge, that's severe internal injuries. Anyway, we made him as comfortable as possible behind a rock and went down to another village, which was, well, we didn't go, we went down the mountain and we tied some vines and sticks together and used the vines and tied them on our feet, which tried to make a kind of a snowshoe, very primitive. And we went down to this other village and they came up and we were just giving up because there was a great big boulder we put them behind where they were sheltered from the wind. And and just as we were giving up, we wouldn't be able to find them, we saw a piece of like long twig waving, and it was Marshall. And during the night, Syme had died, and of course his body went cold, and he was still up here And Marshall, his temperature's body, had kept the snow from freezing, and he was laying down beside him. And he said that Marshall had died about midnight the previous night.
Sime.
Eh?
Sime had died.
Sime had died. And we got Sime, and I got a priest out. The Italians got a priest out, and they dug a grave, and we buried him. And Marshall we took to this other village, and they gave us a place just outside a village. And where we could sort of live. I want to go back a bit, may I?
Yes.
Prior to that, this is rather funny. The blacksmith in Cheskara, the first village, had been in America. And of course, he was a big shot in the village. And his wife, you've seen his old-fashioned these old cartoons of Giles, of Grandma, and she, you know, straight all the way down. She was like that, but by God, did she have guts. She used to say, yes, we must help them. But he wasn't so keen. And she said, now, when you come down for your food on that path, you overlook the veranda at the back of our house. And if there's any fascisti or Tedeschi Germans around, I will hang something white as though it's drying on the line. And I was going down with Sime. We had an old pair of binoculars which they'd lent us. And he put them up and had a look. He just couldn't control himself. He was laughing so much. I said, well, you find a laugh about. And he said, yeah, I had to be using his binoculars. And I looked. And there was a pair of her old-fashioned combinations hanging on a line, and they were like a barrage balloon. But mind you, it did the thing. She said that she'd hang something white. It did the job, told us, you know, keep clear. And that's how we lived for until the avalanche. Now, to go back to the avalanche, we had Sime buried, and he read the service. And we went, and they had us back in the village, but we were not allowed to sleep. We had to in a place where they kept cattle outside. And we, mind you, it was lovely and warm. It was the cattle, it was fine. And we stopped there till one morning the village was surrounded by Germans and fascisti. And we managed to get away. We got up as far as where they were building a hydroelectric place. So something wrong. And we were up there, and they sent all these soldiers out, and they ran us to earth, so we were recaptured.
By Germans?
No, by the Italian fascisti.